Hello, my loves. Welcome back to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? So I don't know if you can quite hear that, but my neighbor is practicing piano next door, and I just love it. I love the fact that I live in a place where my neighbor practices piano. I could have gotten any type of neighbor in the world that made noise, and my neighbor makes music, beautiful music, and I just couldn't be happier. It just makes me really overjoyed every time I hear her practicing. So, my loves, welcome back. As you know, we are at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. We're also on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and more, basically mostly anywhere you might download or stream a podcast. Chances are we are there. If you are on one of those streaming platforms, we always love it if you could like us or give us feedback. Say, hey, I don't really like you. That's okay. But just, you know, give us some stars, give us some attention so we can get bumped up in the rankings and more people can find out about our little podcast, the little podcast that could, that did indeed in 2018 and 2019 become part of the list of top career podcasts. So we couldn't be happier. And again, that's all because of you. So last episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Dawn Jones. She is the founder of Pressed PR, a music PR firm. And she just walked us through that kind of spiritual journey, actually, for her to start her own business in music and what led her to do that. Also leaving sort of a very promising, talented career in country music. But again, she followed her heart, so it's just a great, inspiring story. This week, I have the pleasure of introducing y'all to Jeff Lanier. He is the label manager at Chesky Records. Chesky Records is a Grammy Award-winning indie audiophile label. I'm so glad I got that all out in one breath. Very impressive label out of New York City, and Jeff has a really interesting career going to Drexel University, and he's going to talk about how he actually got recruited as a consultant to Roadrunner Records while still in college, and it just kept blowing up from there. So really good stuff. But before we get to that, here's the track from owner David Chesky of Chesky Records. Here's 52nd Street. Welcome to Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Tell me about your first memories of music. Tell me what it was like to grow up in your household with music.
I have an older brother who's almost a decade older than me, so we would spend a lot of the time that we would spend together, because there's kind of an age gap, we would spend listening to music, watching movies. So I sort of got a lot of my early culture through him. And whether that was listening to Metallica records, Nirvana records, a lot of early hip hop. So I have a very diverse cross section of the things that I grew up listening to and that I still listen to today. But a lot of what I listen to is shaped from listening to CDs with my brother. My parents are, I would say, older than a lot of the parents are from friends my age. So a lot of the things that my parents would expose me to are even older than some of the things that people my age might be exposed to. So I grew up listening to a lot of the stuff from the 40s, 50s, 60s. So there's a lot of references that I have from even older music that sort of permeated the things I listen to. So I'm a big Sinatra fan. I love a lot of early 60s girl groups. So I'm big on the Shirelles. So it's kind of a very diverse cross section.
Was there usually a lot of music being played in the house? People were just kind of rocking out?
More so in my brother's room than my parents breaking out records. But my dad actually has, still to this day, a very large record collection. So I was exposed to the whole vinyl thing before vinyl became cool again.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of a similar thing in that we had like the record player with the two cassette decks. My parents had the record collection, and it was like same kind of thing, late 50s, and then a lot of Beatles, 60s. And then my older sister, when she hit about 11 or 12, started like bringing home the 80s, the 80s hits. So on, you know, 45 or on record. So yeah, totally relate to that. That's pretty cool. Now tell me about was there any musical instruments? Did you play anything when you were growing up?
Yeah, so the embarrassing early start, the first thing I ever played was actually the oboe.
Nice.
To this day, I can't really figure out how that happened other than I remember in elementary school, there was a day where they brought in almost every instrument and you got to sort of play with each of them. And my parents signed me up for a summer camp thing where I literally learned like 2 weeks on each instrument. So I definitely got exposed to all of them, and somehow I chose the oboe, which didn't stick for very long. It wasn't a very cool instrument to be playing. So junior high, I joined a band, as I think most of us do. We started doing covers of a lot of the early rock stuff that I was a fan of, started writing original songs, performing in talent shows, doing that whole thing. And we actually have to do a senior project as well at the high school that I went to. Some people just do community service. Some people do a larger scale project. And the band that I was with, we ended up doing an album as at least my senior project. So we spent a number of years in my high school time crafting that record that we did. We also did our own CD release show, which we booked this. There's a separate gymnasium in our town where you could just book for events. So we set up our own concert, printed our own tickets, did our own sales, had, I don't want to say merch, but had people running sort of concessions at the thing. We definitely were learning and doing the things that I'd end up doing later, just sort of not even realizing that that's what I was doing.
Wow. Now, what were you playing in the band?
I started off playing guitar before, and we had
was just like self-taught.
I would take lessons with sort of some friends in town and also some of the people I would play with. But also, when we first started, there was no bass player. It was just two guys playing guitars and drums and no singer. And it was just because nobody wanted to be the bass player. Everybody wanted to be the lead guitar player. Eventually, after playing a couple of shows like that, I realized that there needs to be a bass player. And honestly, the guitar player that we had was better than I was. So, you know, eat your humble pie, grab the bass, start playing that. But I ended up really enjoying playing the bass. So bass is probably what I would call my predominant instrument, not that I'm an active musician.
That I'm surprised that there was snobbery about the bass.
I don't think it was so much as looking down on the bass as it was holding the high esteem, the lead guitar.
Oh, that's funny. Huh. So when you were planning and doing this whole project and with an album and this band, were there any aspirations to kind of continue this, or what happened?
I think initially, you know, as a kid, you had those aspirations, but looking back, I had so many things pulling me in different directions that I don't think I ever devoted the time to it that if that was the actual dream, it would have accomplished. Because I was also, obviously, school took up a lot of time and I excelled at school as best I could, and also played three sports at different parts. So, and, you know, at a significantly high level for a couple of them. So I was devoting my time across a lot of different things, so I don't think I was necessarily doing the best I could at any of them.
Were you aiming for like an athletic scholarship, or what direction did you take?
I don't know that it was that, because I'm a very odd size and shape as far as that goes.
Sorry, that's funny.
Well, like I'm 5'9", and at the time I was probably 200 pounds. So there's not too many sports where you can do that. I played baseball, I played football, and I wrestled, which I did end up wrestling in college, but I wasn't like a scholarship athlete. I ended up doing it mostly to sort of prove that I could. Mm-hmm. But no, it wasn't that, you know, people weren't beating down the door to have me come play sports there. It was a secondary thing. Where I went to school also happened to be great at wrestling, and I walked on, so.
Nice. So tell me about your decision for college. Like what were you going to pursue? What degree, et cetera?
Yeah. So I thought about that it changed a couple times throughout high school, but I did realize in doing all of these projects that music was something I wanted to pursue. And the career as the musician was probably not going to happen and also incredibly difficult. So I was like, oh, I'll just do the business side of it because, you know, that'll be easier, which not realizing how difficult the business side of music is also. I looked at a few local colleges, and it's weird in hindsight to think of the schools that I didn't look at. Like, I never even looked at NYU. I never looked at USC. But there was a kid I used to wrestle in high school a lot who committed to Drexel. And when I saw him wearing the t-shirt, I'd never heard of Drexel. So I ended up looking into the school, and they had a music business program. And they had their own record label, and there was a lot of cool things that they were doing. So I ended up taking a visit to Drexel and learning more about the curriculum. I thought it was cool that they only took, I think at the time, they only took 50 kids each year, regardless of how many applicants applied. There's a competitive nature to me that kind of liked that part of it, but also it's in Philadelphia, so it wasn't too far from where I was from. It was a bit of a step as far as the nature of the city from where I'm from to Philadelphia was kind of a big step. But looking back, it's nice that I had that step in between where I'm from and New York, because that would have been even more of a cultural shift.
What was your kind of idea in terms of when you thought music business? Were you thinking like managing bands, running your own record label, working for a major record label? What was kind of your outlook at that time?
Well, because we had done my band's project between mostly at the drummer that I was working with. We did most of it at his house, at his recording studio. But we had done some parts of it in my basement recording studio. And I'm from a very small town, so some other people who were doing their senior project wanted to do a recording as well, and they ended up coming to me to do the recordings. So I was like, oh, I can, there's a, on a recording side of this, that could be a job. There could be a job at labels. There could be a job as managers. I didn't necessarily know what my field would be, but between the recording side of it, and then also I'd always sort of had an eye towards finding the next cool band. When I used to go shopping for records, I would literally just buy records from bands I'd never heard of based off of the packaging and the artwork. As a tween, that was sort of my version of what A&R was, even though obviously those bands were signed to major labels and I wasn't aware of any of that kind of stuff. I was looking for the bands that none of my friends had heard of, you know, even if they were still on a major label. But I had sort of already begun looking for the next band to be interested in.
So I want to kind of touch back on the whole recording studio in your basement, because I don't think that that's really small potatoes. Like, I don't think that, you know, every kid's like, I want to set up a recording studio. So I want to hear more about that. Like, how did you figure out how to do that? Like, what were your resources? Where did you have people telling you how to do stuff, buy equipment, et cetera?
I use the term recording studio that I had there pretty loosely, because obviously that what I consider a recording studio has changed a bit. But I'm like, essentially the first thing I'd ever recorded was with my dad's reel-to-reel tape and straight to two-track. My friend and I, the first song I ever wrote, that's what we started with. Then some friends of mine had a Zoom multi-track recorder that I think could do 8 tracks. And they weren't using it, so I bought that from them, and I started recording with 8 tracks and essentially just playing with it and learning as I went. So I would get, you know, however many microphones I could get, some of them, you know, from Radio Shack, some of them online, and just start experimenting with things.
And did you, like, soundproof or anything?
Oh, God, no. my parents' basement is concrete,
nice.
And the ductwork could not have rattled more if I tried.
I love it. Maybe it's like it adds to the it adds to the recording, you know. It's like it sounds really cool.
It gives you experience about, God, how do I make that sound better?
Right. Right, exactly. So, just to reiterate, so you basically you weren't afraid of like jumping in there, getting your hands dirty, trying your hand at recording. So this is something that you definitely kind of saw that you would continue sort of learning on a more formal level, that kind of thing, or?
Yeah, and I learned a lot from the drummer in the band that I was working with. He did it a lot more rigorously and routinely than I did, because he was also recording other people, but he wasn't sort of dividing his time as much as I was. So there are things I could pick up from him. There were things I could pick up just from trial and error. Unfortunately, not just in this area, but in so much of my career and life, a lot of my wisdom comes from prior stupidity. So
yeah, well,
it's, I make a mistake and I learn from it that way, for better or worse.
Well, I think, yeah, you're not alone in that. That's for sure. So, all right, I want to hear about Drexel. And it's so funny. I mean, I had another guest on recently who went to Drexel, Suzanne Polinsky, and she now runs a coach consultant for musicians. So she had she sounds like she had an amazing experience at Drexel. So I'm curious to hear your experience.
Yeah, she actually went, I think, before me. I never met her during my time there, but we've met since. Yeah, it was a great experience, especially the part where they have their own record label in-house, so you can already start doing a lot of the things that you would end up doing later. So I had a lot of experience getting to do PR, which helped me realize I didn't want to do PR. But the first day, when you first get there, they have your first class. There's the 50 of us sitting there. They ask you the whole, what do you want to do when you graduate thing? You stand up, you introduce yourself. And I said I wanted to do A&R for Roadrunner Records. And I always look back on that fondly because it was my junior year, something like that. I ended up getting a consulting relationship with Roadrunner Records going. I would also intern there, but the A&R consulting role that I got there, after having said that my first day, is always kind of a fun story.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk about like manifestation to get all woo-woo, you know. Set that intention first day. I love it.
One of my professors is friends with, at the time, the head of A&R for Roadrunner, and he had him come in to speak. And he had talked to me before Dave came in to speak, saying that he was going to be there. So he invited me to pop into class, even though I wasn't in that class. And I brought with me a CD of bands that I thought that he should check out, and it had my contact information on it. So gave it to him, met him. A couple weeks later, he invited me up for an interview in New York, which was my first time ever in New York, actually. And I ended up getting to be a regional talent scout. So essentially a consultant for them for a couple of years.
Now, was this while you were at Drexel, or is this after?
Yes.
While you were at Drexel. Wow. Now, my understanding of Drexel, too, is that it's sort of the ultimate music business school, because a lot of the faculty, they're essentially taken straight out of the music industry. This isn't sort of the ivory tower kind of thing, but that people have real, you know, they've sort of cut their teeth with a lot of experiences sort of on the road, so to speak. Did you find that to be the case?
Yeah, I mean, Terry, who is the professor that I just sort of mentioned, he was an A&R guy at Sony for a number of years. Marcy, who was helping run the program, was a lawyer and songwriter for years. Darren runs his own independent record label in Delaware. I mean, you can sort of just run down the list of people that are actively doing things. And not only doing their own things, but because there is an in-house record label, we're actively working on other projects as well.
That's cool. Now, you said that you had a CD of bands. How did you discover them? What was kind of your method of discovering new music or new talent?
It's gotten a little bit more educated over the years, but a lot of it just boiled down to a combination of, well, I like it, and even back then, there were some metrics involved of what were the things happening for the band. It can't just be, well, I find it interesting, but is there anything happening? Is there momentum? Are they touring? Are they getting syncs? Are there, you know, this was the very early days of social media, so that wasn't as much of a part of it. Like, what are their numbers? But there's still a lot of just quantifiable things to also mix in. But also, I was, in essence, responsible for specific regions. So it's sort of like what's happening in this area. And also, I always sort of pride myself on finding things that are unique, because there are certain bands or artists that are buzzing that kind of every A&R guy already knows about, and you don't really need me to tell you about. I took pride in finding the thing where the person's response was, where the hell did you find that? Like, what is this?
Exactly. So that's kind of my question. Where the hell did you find them? Did you end up just going to a lot of like hole in the wall venues, or like how did you kind of first get exposed to them?
That's never really been my way of going about it. When I'm at a show, it's because I'm already interested and I'm usually just there to have my suspicions confirmed or denied. I only need to be there for like 5 minutes in most cases to see if what I thought was true is true. Yeah, I can't give too much of the secret sauce away, but there's always certain places where...
Let's go back. Let's like talk about before. So at Drexel, like what was your, can you tell your secret sauce that when you were at Drexel before social media was a click away kind of thing?
Well, so much of it is just whatever. I try to not be too genre specific because I have ended up working in numerous genres, but whatever genre you're working in, there's a scene for that. So you just got to sort of plug yourself into it and things will sort of naturally come to you. So it's if you're working at a punk label and you're trying to find punk bands, well then who's playing the really cool shows or tours, or who's opening for the bands that are really big, or who just got an interesting commercial sync, or there's just the more that you're actively following the people who are doing things really well, you'll find all of the sort of tangential talents.
That's interesting. What about just sort of like those that haven't reached that level yet? Were you able to kind of tap into that like truly underground kind of thing where they're not, you know, no one's sort of heard of them kind of thing?
You always want to try to find a balance of, like I was saying, you don't want to just pitch them the bands that they already know about because they've got people working on it full time. But at the same time, if there's nothing happening for the band, it's kind of hard to pitch that artist. Because so much of a pitch meeting is going in with a story, like here's why you should be interested, not just, well, the song's great.
Right.
Because especially now it's so hard to put all of the resources into completely developing from scratch. There needs to be some stuff has already happened. Like now when artists ask me like, so what's your advice for a band that's trying to get signed or trying to get someone's attention? It's if you're doing things correctly or things are happening as they should be, we're going to find out about you anyway, which they hate that because it doesn't sound like they can proactively do anything about it. But if you're behaving in a manner where you don't need the label, then that's usually when they're going to start coming to you. But if you were playing the right shows, if you're gaining traction, if you're gaining momentum, things start happening for you, then you're going to hit whatever each individual A&R person is looking for or wherever they're looking, you're eventually going to cross that person's path. You're going to play the venue that they love to go look at bands. You're going to play that festival. You're going to maybe get that manager who has their connection. You're going to get played on that radio station that they enjoy listening to. It has to happen organically, and it can happen overnight sometimes.
The way I usually discover music besides Spotify is like BBC introducing kind of thing, because I always feel like BBC is like 6 months to a year ahead of us. They also, what's interesting to me is sometimes they have artists that I almost feel like it's like very carefully curated to look as if they really don't have any kind of presence online and look like they're sort of, I don't know, like almost deceptively super small or super undiscovered, almost as like kind of a tease, if you will, like, no one knows about me, and yet you've stumbled across me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's certain places that take up a degree of pride in being the first to break things. And that's another, like sometimes it's difficult if you're falling into like that career, that part of your career where you're not necessarily an established star, but you're also not a new and emerging thing either. Sometimes it's trying to avoid falling into that middle ground. At the end of the day, it's as far as finding things that fit whoever you're working for or pitching for, it's keeping in mind the culture. What is the company looking for? What types of things do they do well with? And then also remembering what success is defined by where you're working, because that varies from place to place too.
That's a great point. Yeah. Like you're saying, yeah, some take pride and sort of, you know, determined to stay out of the mainstream or determined to stay out of the usual.
Well, I mean, not only that, just like as an example, I know I'm skipping ahead, but like with Chesky Records, we record in a very specific way. So a lot of what I'm looking for is it has to fit what we do. I want it to be successful and interesting in all the other ways that I would normally, but on top of that, it needs to fit the culture of what we do. So the same thing could apply if you're, when you're talking about a metal label or a hip hop label. It's not just what's interesting, what's compelling, what's going to make sense from a business standpoint, but what makes sense and fits here.
Got it. Got it. No, that's a great point. Well, let's go back to Drexel. So you are working at Roadrunner, and then what happened after that? Is that the only outside place that you were working while you were at school?
I did both. I was an intern for one summer, and I was a regional talent scout, which was a consulting role. I started off being the talent scout and then also did an internship, because just for school, you have to do internships as well. So, and part of that's being, you know, because as a regional talent scout, I don't necessarily have to be in the office, whereas in the internship, I get to then go to the office, see some of the things that I don't get to see when I'm mostly just going out and seeing bands and sending reports. There I can actually go in and see a little bit more of the day-to-day. But I also interned at Ropadope, which is a Philadelphia-based jazz label for the most part. It's jazz. They do some other sort of, with some hip-hop elements as well, which they've done really well not too pretty recently with Snarky Puppy was one of theirs. But those were the two internships while I was there, while I was at Drexel.
So what happened upon graduation?
I moved to New York because I actually graduated a little bit early, one term early. I took an internship at Nielsen, the folks who run SoundScan. I took some other part-time jobs when I was first starting out, which that was sort of the most difficult period of time. It was really getting your foothold in New York, being able to pay rent. And most of the stuff I was doing was either like consulting or internships or part-time stuff. So that was for the better part of probably half a year or so before I got like my first full-time gig in New York.
Before we continue, I'm just curious, did you look anywhere else, or was it sort of New York or bust?
Well, in Philadelphia where I was, the opportunities were fairly limited because it's, for the most part, it's kind of a live sound town. There aren't too many labels other than, you know, Ropadope, Jade Tree's close, Relapse is there. But for the most part, it's a lot of live sound. So it was more my opportunities are going to be New York, Los Angeles, Nashville. But so much of me, I guess, coming from a small town, in hindsight, again, I never really even thought about Nashville or Los Angeles. It was just, all right, New York's 90 minutes away. I know it somewhat from the times I've spent in New York, even though, to be perfectly honest, before I moved to New York, most of my experiences of New York were getting on the bus, walking to the office, leaving the office, walking back to the bus, and going back to Philly. I didn't spend a lot of downtime in New York. I got a job at SAE, which is an audio engineering school, and I was essentially, I help the graduates of the school get work in various fields. So a lot of them are going to be record producers, recording engineers, audiovisual technicians, live sound guys, you know, all sorts of different things. But I was essentially, my job was, you know, career services was like the official title, but I'm essentially the industry relations person for the school. So making relationships with studios, labels, companies to try to get grads gigs, also to help them figure out how to freelance, work on resumes, do networking events with graduates and employers. So essentially just try to be like the networking guy for them.
That's very cool. And that does sound like an awesome position for yourself as well in terms of networking and reaching out to all the different studios, et cetera. What was it like for graduates? Was there like a pretty good market for them?
It really depends what you want to do. And I was, before they graduated, you'd always sit down and talk to each of them individually and sort of what's your goal here? And if your goal was just, I want to do audio and I want a job, then I could usually have a pretty optimistic outlook for you. But some of the things are more difficult. You know, recording studios are closing and or it's moving into people's houses increasingly. So the traditional, I'm going to work at this giant recording studio, the way that it used to work in the 80s and 90s is sort of being phased out. So it's, if you if you're entrepreneurial, there's always that there's a lot of work out there. Sometimes it's more finding it than necessarily just getting a regular, it's never going to be 9 to 5, but a staff salary job at a studio might be more difficult to find. But maybe if you're willing to do AV, you could get a job at, you know, there's a ton of financial places in New York, marketing places in New York, where people don't necessarily think that, oh yeah, they've got full-time audio people on hand, but they do. Like a JP Morgan, every time they're having a giant P&L meeting about their profit and losses for quarter one, and there's 200 people in that meeting, there's a sound guy running that meeting. Whether people think about it or not, that's an audio job, and it takes a person who knows the same stuff that a recording engineer does to make that happen.
Right, that's a great point. And then obviously digital media, a bunch of places now have, you know, marketing, et cetera, have their own sort of in-house studios. Yeah, that's a great point. I'm curious. Yeah, talk to me a little bit about the fact, I was thinking about that before the interview, like that so much has now moved into people's bedrooms, et cetera. What do you think about that? Like, what's kind of your take on that and the landscape?
Yeah, like, I mean, podcasting, like right now.
I'm in my bedroom.
It's because the same thing applies to music, the democratization to where now everyone can make a record. Sort of a similar concept. Doesn't necessarily mean that because you can make a record, you should. And much in the way that I think photographers have been impacted by the digital camera and now everyone's a photographer, the same thing is sort of happening with audio. But I still think that the cream rises to the top, rather. If you bring someone on for a project and they're not actually very good, you're going to end up finding a professional in the long run because you have to hire someone to fix the mistake that the other person made.
Yeah.
Which is not to say that someone working out of their home can't be fantastic, because now you've got some amazing producers and engineers working out of their house. So that they're able to do that is great. You provided an opportunity for someone to have a job without necessarily having huge overhead. But you have also opened the door to, well, now everyone's a producer, everyone's an engineer.
Right. I mean, as evidenced on this podcast, like I think a number of engineers have kind of moved into the YouTube space in terms of tutorials, because there is such a large audience now of, you know, musicians that want to record from home and don't know how and want to find out. And so there's sort of this lucrative secondary market that's kind of opened up.
Yeah. I mean, I know people now who, I mean, just with podcasting, they are only doing engineering for podcasting. So now it's ebbs and flows. It's like any other business. It changes and adapts. We're not unique in that. I feel like sometimes we feel like the music business is super unique, but it's like any other. It ebbs, it flows, it evolves.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I interviewed a guy who's developing an app that will sort of automate the mixing and mastering process. So we'll see how that.
I saw something online yesterday about an automated mastering thing that I sent to one of my mastering engineer friends. Like, have you heard about this? They hadn't. So I'm sure they're looking into it right now. But.
And my own personal opinion is that I believe that having another producer to mix and master, or an engineer to mix and master, for me is really important, because it's also like, I believe it's also kind of another art form. You know, no two mixer, master, engineers are alike. Also, I think it's important to just, this is just my opinion, but to have sort of that second opinion. Do you really want to have your kick really that loud? Or, you know what I mean? I just think it's sometimes it's almost like trying to write a book without an editor kind of thing.
Oh, absolutely. You always need a second set of ears just to make sure, because also the longer you're working on something, the more you're hearing what you think you want to hear as opposed to what you're actually hearing.
Yep. Yep, exactly. I know. I've been there. Okay, so you're doing the career services, and then what happened after that?
So simultaneously, I'm doing my own other things while I'm doing that. So consulting for the New Music Seminar. They do this thing called the Artist on the Verge, where the New Music Seminar was sort of like a CMJ, where you'd have panels and bands would play. It's like a festival / conference. And Artists on the Verge was their list of emerging artists that they thought were going to break out over the next year or so. So I started off working on the committee for that. So essentially finding the bands for the list of the top 100. From that, they would book who would play. I ended up taking over that committee for the last couple of years. So I was doing that. I was producing and engineering stuff for artists on my own. And I was setting up essentially showcases at different recording studios where I'd be live recording bands and inviting industry people out to watch and putting the videos up on YouTube as a promotional means for the band. I guess I'm trying to think of a similar concept, but maybe sort of similar to Audio Tree, if you know Audio Tree.
No, I don't.
Except that I think they actually are selling theirs. But so I was doing showcases and working with bands in addition to all of my other activities with getting work for grads.
Like, how did you get the On the Verge committee job? Because that sounds really cool. Like, how did you pitch yourself for that?
No, one of the artists that I did a session with and a showcase was involved. I think she was running the green room for the New Music Seminar. And I guess she enjoyed her experience working with me doing a session and seeing all the other bands that I was working with and sort of the curated nature of the bands that I was working with. She suggested me to the person, the GM of the New Music Seminar. And I happened to also know the person who was at the time in charge of the Artists on the Verge committee. So it was a pretty seamless process in bringing me on to help.
Nice. And obviously the importance of networking and keeping good connections.
Yeah. Everyone you meet could end up being beneficial to your career or not. But beyond that, try to see them as people too. Sometimes people get a little bit too logged into what they think someone can do to help them as opposed to just meeting them and building a relationship with them as a person.
Right, exactly. Great point. So did you have sort of a clear-cut strategy in place, or was it just more about, you know, it just sounds like you were like hitting the ground running and at any opportunity you had to, you know, work with bands, showcase bands, you know, to work with various people in the industry, et cetera?
No, I always thought that everything I was doing helped everything else that I was doing. So like the work that I was doing for the school was to help grads get work. The things I was doing outside of that was to make it so I am getting better at the engineering side of things, which helps me give them advice. I'm doing stuff at studios, so I'm meeting more and more people at studios, and I'm becoming a client of those studios, which makes them like me even more. So when they're thinking of, hey, I need a new engineer, hopefully they think of me first, because you can hire an engineer any different number of ways. What I always wanted was people to approach me first when they needed somebody. It was also helping me in finding bands, because again, I didn't necessarily want to be an engineer. I wanted to be the person who's finding the artist. So I would occasionally be able to siphon off work to people. Everything helped everything. One thing made me better than the next.
I'm curious though about the engineering thing, because you weren't like getting a formal degree in it. Again, was it all just everything that you just had picked up along the way?
Yeah. So actually, I guess in our earlier part about Drexel, I didn't mention there were tracks. So you could go three different tracks. There was business track, tech track, and legal track. I ended up going the business track, because one of the things I learned pretty early on was that I didn't want to be an engineer. Like, while I can do it, I have done a considerable amount of it. It wasn't what I wanted to spend my career doing. The business side of it, specifically the A&R side of it, was what intrigued me. So it was a means to an end. I enjoy the technical side of it to the ends that I enjoy the overall business creative.
Got it. I guess my question is, how did you learn, though, enough to be able to be an engineer on tracks? Again, was it just you were just continually sort of evolving your experience along the way, sort of like hands-on?
As much as I possibly could, I would hire engineers to do the bulk of the work. So especially if we're talking about the showcase sessions that I was doing, I had tracking engineers working on it, and for some of them, mixing engineers. So I was having great engineers working on things. I would occasionally end up engineering things myself as well, but I found the better the engineer that you used tracking it, the easier the mix and master is. It's also, you know, live and learn. And unfortunately, you know, like I was saying before, my wisdom today comes from yesterday's stupidity sometimes.
Yesterday's mistakes.
Right.
We won't call it stupidity, but yeah. Well, that's great. And that's really cool. And I like the fact that you were, you know, you weren't just talking the talk, that you were kind of like in there with your sleeves rolled up, you know, you knew exactly what all the parameters were, you know, so you weren't just some sort of like talking head that didn't really have the direct experience.
Yeah. And I try to every day improve is both what I was thinking then, the way I see things now, which, you know, sometimes you look back and you're like, oh, I'm so much better now than I was then. But you have to look at it as the only way that that's been able to be possible is because of the things that I did then.
Yep, exactly. I know we always have to look at that as building blocks.
But you listen to a mix you did 5 years ago, or a project you worked on, or a creative endeavor that you did, and you're like, oh, if I were doing that today, I'd do this way. I would have done this better. But the only way that you got to the point where you are now is because you did that.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Speaking to the preaching of the choir, as they say. Right. I opened an old track of mine and I was like, oh, that's right. You didn't know how to like quantize when you did this. You know what I mean? Like having to readjust everything. So anyway, talk to me about Chesky. When did this pop into the picture?
Yeah, so because the sessions that I was doing, the showcase sessions, were, for the most part, they were live and recorded with no additional effects. Because I would send the videos out to industry people as well as the invitations that I would do. And the goal was to represent the live performance as close as humanly possible. So there was a job opening at a record label called Chesky Records. And what they do is, at least up until recently, it was binaural. So a binaural is a single microphone that's shaped like the human head. And it has two ears, which are where the capsules are located. So it records the sound of the room in 360 and in high definition as if you are the dummy head. So it's essentially like a 3D audio type of feel. And the albums are recorded in a single day, straight to 2-track, and no effects. Not necessarily live, because they're doing multiple takes that get edited together, but for the most part, it's a relatively live type of recording. So what I was doing was about as close to that as you can probably get without just literally doing a binaural recording. So I was coming at it from a very similar methodology of, let's take this band and take a picture of what they do and represent it as best we can. So when they posted that they were looking for a label manager, it seemed like a very unique opportunity to combine the A&R background, the live performance recording stuff that I'd been doing, and then also I'd had enough of an exposure from my internships at Rope-A-Dope and Roadrunner to see some of the other sides of it, and also from my time at Mad Dragon Records, which was Drexel's record label. Now, I understood PR, I understood marketing, but obviously A&R and the creative side of it being a little bit more where my heart is.
So talk to me a little bit about, because again, I think Chesky is, it's like it's old school, but it's so essential. And I could see Chesky becoming more and more relevant and more essential as we, you know, continue ever more into the world of streaming and everything becoming less and less real. Do you know what I mean? And more virtual.
Yeah. David, one of the owners, he likes to say that it's taking a picture of an artist as opposed to making a painting. So instead of, and not that there's different approaches. One's not better or worse than another. It's instead of layering and layering and layering a song and working on one song for weeks at a time, it's perform the song. And that is what it is. Well, you do a couple of takes, you edit it together, but for the most part, you're trying to capture the essence of the song, the feel, the vibe, the emotion, not necessarily just, you know, hit every note perfectly. And you have sort of an emotionless type of experience. You want to feel like you're in the room with the band and they're performing for you. And that's not just the high definition audio part of it where they're trying to make it as crisp as possible. It's not just the binaural effect where there's a surround sound feeling to it, but it's also just the organic nature in which it was created, in that they're going in knowing I'm doing an album in a day. I'm conveying this to the listener about as organically as I can, short of sitting next to them and singing in their ear.
Wow, that's phenomenal. What's been so far kind of your favorite band that you've seen record there that was just like phenomenal, that really blew it out?
I can't say my absolute favorite, but some of my favorites. And I'm obviously partial because some of these were, you know, I helped bring in. So City of the Sun was one of my favorites. I don't know if you're familiar with them. They're an instrumental post-rock meets flamenco band. So,
oh wow,
no vocals, two guitars, and percussion. And it's already sort of atmospheric in its nature. So when you're recording in a church, which is something I forgot to mention, we do all of this in a church where there's a great natural ambience anyway. And you factor all that in, it really, it's the perfect artist for the recording methodology, which is when I go back to, you know, when you're looking for an artist, what are you looking for? Part of it is fit. The fit there was fantastic. And those are records that really hold up well, both from a sound standpoint, but then also that album is at, I think, almost 28, 29 million streams on Spotify. So it's connected to not only the audiophile audience who is there for the sound, but the music has obviously resonated with a lot of people. That's one that's close to me. Macy Gray was another really big one because we did her first jazz record. And because we did it stripped down, which it was literally called stripped, and you know, no frills, no excess, no 808s. It was just what's Macy Gray's voice sound like in a great acoustic environment with a fantastic band with all the extra stuff stripped away. And that was another moment where she starts singing the first couple of lines in the song first time and you get the hair on your arm standing up. You're like, all right, this was a good idea. This works.
That's amazing. Now, is anything degraded when it's streaming?
Oh, of course. I mean, especially with Spotify, it's just an MP3. And when we're recording in 192.24. So we're recording in incredibly high definition. But, and because everything is made available, if people want to purchase that, they can purchase the high resolution version. But I'm, as especially the label manager, I look at it as I try to service a number of markets. If the audiophile market, I want them to have the highest resolution, greatest sounding one they possibly can. And I hope that they love that. For the audience who's listening on Spotify, doesn't necessarily care about the sonic quality, I hope that the music speaks to them. And we're doing stuff now on CD. We're doing records on vinyl. So if people want stuff on wax cylinder, then we'll maybe we'll look at that. It's I want to impact as many people as possible in a meaningful way.
What's your take on physical product? I mean, do you think it's going to become completely obsolete, or will there still be sort of a very edified, specialized population that will still continue to purchase physical product?
I think there will always be physical product in some form or fashion. I think there's a tangible connection that you create with it. And regardless of what someone's motivation is, because people have different opinions on, like, why is vinyl coming back? Is it that tangible connection? Is it just the put on your wall brag factor? Is it the different colors and packaging? I think it's all of those things and different answers for different people. But there is, especially if you have a deep connection and there's a true fandom, which sometimes doesn't happen with streaming. I feel people are now often fans of songs, not necessarily fans of bands. But when they are a fan of that band, there is that connection, then they do want a physical product. They want to do a meet and greet with the band and get a vinyl and have them sign it. And there's a connection that's made there that's not made with, oh, there's a song on this playlist that I'm really into that... Which is fine. There's different ways to consume, but I think that for that very big fan, they're going to want that connection piece.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's the best physical product for people to truly experience, like the Chesky method?
Well, I never like to say best because people like different things about different ones. You can get, we have things called SACDs that have probably the highest resolution that you're going to get.
Okay.
But vinyl has a very certain sound to it that some people like, some people don't. And it's usually been mastered differently for vinyl. So there, it is inherently going to sound a little bit different.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, the packaging's bigger. So sometimes people get, there's a deeper connection to that than if you're going through a CD, which has smaller pictures, smaller lettering, that might matter to you. It's really, what's very cool about it is it's a very unique and personal relationship that you have to music and the medium.
That's a great point. Do you want to give out any contact information or just share Chesky's website or any social media you want to
Yeah, the website is just chesky.com, C-H-E-S-K-Y.com. We're on Facebook, Twitter, all this stuff's on the website as well. We have a new record coming out May 31st. I don't know when this podcast is coming out, but May 31st, we have a new album called Jazz from Casey Abrams, who is from America. You might remember from American Idol. He's also the bass player in Postmodern Jukebox. You're at LA, right?
Yep.
He has a CD release show May 31st as well.
Nice.
And he has two New York City release shows middle of June at Birdland.
Cool. Now, are you doing any outside consulting, or are you pledging allegiance just to Chesky right now?
No, I just do Chesky stuff at this point.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, Jeff, thank you so much. It was so fun having you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks to Jeff for a great interview. And again, it's chesky.com, C-H-E-S-K-Y.com. They're also on the Twitter at Chesky Label, and they're on Facebook. So be sure to like, subscribe, share, and be sure to check out their latest album release, which I believe is actually perfect timing, dropping the same time we air this podcast. So make sure you run out and get it as soon as you can. Okay, my loves, this ends another week of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host. Hostess with the mostest, L Ariel, L dot Ariel. I am at LARIELmusic.com. That's LARIELmusic.com. The podcast is on social media at Music Jobs Podcast. And I also am on social media at LARIEL Music. Stop by, say hi, tell me what is going on. I would love to hear from you. Okay, babies. So take a good care. Have a wonderful, productive, happy week. I think summer is, I believe it's around the corner. I think it's in a matter of weeks. So hold on. I know the weather has been insane, but hold on. Summer is coming. Okay, babies, so take good care. And we are going to keep on hustling, pursue that dream. And don't you give up.